he'd pull international visas of students who were protesting. Your final thoughts in 5 seconds.
Fascism isn't coming, Amy. It's here.
Mehdi Hassan, the editor-in-chief of the media website Zatteo, which is celebrating its one-year anniversary this week. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of Democracy Now!
You're listening to Veterans Voices, the first Gulf War.
I'm Casey Mahon. I'm a retired Air Force officer. I went into the Air Force in 1976 as an enlisted guy. Did that for 10 years, got my commission and my degree, and the next 10 years as a public affairs officer. And I went up to Plattsburgh Air Force Base, was there for 4.5 years. And during that time, I was deployed to Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And I was told, you're going to Riyadh, and you're going to be assigned to General Schwarzkopf's public affairs staff. We stopped for an overnight in England, and then we flew direct into Saudi Arabia. My roommate and I had just gotten off a 12-hour shift. We were just getting ready to go to bed, and all of a sudden we heard this air raid sign that we never heard before. And we just kind of looked at each other and said, what's that? And then there was a huge explosion. I mean, the building just completely shook. And we both ran in our opposite directions to our rooms to get our chemical warfare outfits on. What happened is that there was a Scud that came into Riyadh. There was a Patriot battery, and that explosion was the Patriot taking off and breaking the speed of sound. I mean, we were petrified. That's when I knew we were in war.
Veterans Voices, The First Gulf War, is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, and is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
The viewpoints expressed in this program are the opinions of the people expressing them and are not necessarily those of Fresh Air Incorporated, its staff, or its board of directors.
You are listening to Fresh Air Community Radio 90.3 FM, KFAI Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at KFAI.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. Welcome to Northern Sun News. Don Olson will not be in this week. He will be back next week. But before we go any further, I would like to introduce the national chair for the Old Gardening Party, Mr. Larry Johnson.
Thank you. And I was the Old Gardening Party is the OGP. I was going to sit here for an hour with Don today and bounce back and forth stories, multiple diverse stories of conscientious objection, of people who have had over the years the courage to say, I will not deliberately take another's person's life in war. I will fight to find ways to solve international differences without violence. But we'll do that another day. The reason we were going to do it today was because next Thursday at 7 o'clock, May 15th, at the Friends Meeting House in Linden Hills, 44th Street and York Avenue, a group of people are coming together to do that very thing, to tell their stories, their own stories or stories of friends and family who have had that courage. We're having it in Linden Hills because Minnesota's most famous conscientious objector, Lou Ayers, grew up a few blocks from the church. He was famous as Dr. Kildare in the movie and declared conscientious objection during World War II. Don, as many of you may know, was one of the Minnesota Eight, and Tom Troe and others produced a film on them for Channel 2 for PBS, an argument for supporting public media like PBS and like Fresh Air Radio. And I could go on, but we'll do that when this time with Don gets rescheduled, or next Thursday night at the Friends Meeting House. Thank you, Miguel.
Oh, yeah, you got it. Friends Meeting House, tell the folks where that is again.
It's 44th 401 York Avenue South in Linden Hills, South Minneapolis. And, you know, more information, hopefully the person at the desk would know that, but you could email Larry J., VFP, V as in veteran, F as in four, P as in peace, at gmail.com. And, you know, we can send you more information on that event. Larry J., VFP, at gmail.com.
All right. That was Larry Johnson, national chair for the Old Gardening Party. And now, as we mentioned, Don Olson will be back next week. And for now, enjoy this encore of last week's broadcast of Northern Sun News.
You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, KFAI, 90.3 FM Minneapolis, St. Paul, and around the world at kfai.org. Non-commercial, community-powered radio. 1 o'clock at this time is the Northern Sun Radio News Show with your host, Don Olson. And today we have a couple of in-studio guests who will be talking about their Vietnam experiences, veterans. And we're going to, and I have an interview for later on, but we're going to start off with Phil Oakes talking Vietnam.
Sailing over to Vietnam, Southeast Asian Birmingham. Well, training is the word we use, nice word to have in case we lose. Training a million Vietnamese to fight for the wrong government and the American way. Well, they put me in a barracks house just across the way from Laos. They said you're pretty safe when the troops deploy, but don't turn your back in your house, boy. When they ring the gong, watch out for the Viet Cong. Well, the sergeant said it's time to train, so I climbed aboard my helicopter plane. We flew above the battleground, a sniper tried to shoot us down. He must have forgot we're only trainees. Them commies never fight fair. Friends, the very next day we trained some more. We burned some villages down to the floor. Yes, we burned out the jungles far and wide. Made sure those red apes had no place left to hide. Threw all the people in relocation camps. Under lock and key, made damn sure they're free. Well, I walked through the jungle around the bend. Who should I meet but the ghost of President Diem? Said you're fighting to keep Vietnam free for good old democracy. That means rule by one family and 15,000 American troops, give or take a few thousand American troops. He said I was a fine old Christian man ruling this backward Buddhist land. Well, it ain't much, but what the heck? It sure beats hell at a Chiang Kai-shek. I'm the power elite, me and the Seventh Fleet. He said, meet my sister, Madam Nu, the sweetheart of Dien Bien Phu. He said, meet my brothers, meet my aunts, with a government that doesn't take a chance. Families that slay together, stay together. Said if you want to stay, well, you have to pay over $1 million a day. But it's worth it all. Now, don't you see, if you lose the country, you still have me. Me and Sigmund Rhee, Chiang Kai-shek, Madam Nu. Like I said on Meet the Press, I regret that I have but one country to give for my life. Well, now old DM is gone and dead. All the new leaders are anti-red. Yes, they're pro-American freedom sensations against Red China and the United Nations. Now all the news commentators and the CIA are saying, thank God for coincidence.
Dropped my headphone, and here I am back at it, right? Okay. And today I have two guests in the studio today. Strong Buffalo, who is a Dakota, a poet. He was a Vietnam veteran, drafted into the Marines, joined up the Marines, 1968 to 70. And he has a group that he fronts for that plays, sings for, called Buffalo Weavers. And I have Dave Logsdon.
Hello.
Who, of course, is the president of our local That's for Peace Chapter 27. Welcome both to talking here.
And I'm also a Vietnam veteran, Don, and I was a U.S. Navy in the fall of 1967, which incidentally is where Tet was going on in theater. I was floating up and down the coast of Vietnam, and for the most part, it was pretty uneventful until you got north of the DMZ, and then we exchanged mucho firepower with the well-entrenched North Vietnamese shore battery.
Even being on a ship, you were getting incoming.
We got hit twice. We had to go back to Subic, have a couple big holes. One of them hit the captain's cabin, which nobody really shed any tears about. He had to sleep with the proletariat a little bit more.
Subic Bay, of course, is in the Philippines, which is a It's a distance away.
Yeah, right. So we had to limp back to Subic Bay. Yeah.
And Strong Buffalo. Why don't you talk a little bit about what you wanted to say about your memories of Vietnam, and also you have poetry that you have. So start off as you wish.
All right. Thank you. Like you said, I was drafted. So I went in the Marines instead of the Army, or the Navy, like Dave.
Yeah.
And I had grew up with Catholic welfare in the Twin Cities, and there was an Indian from Cass Lake who was my foster brother's brother. He was about 6'7", 6'8", and he went into the Marine Corps, and he had an eagle feather he had gotten, and we saw him before he went into the service, and I was pretty impressed with that. And I kind of grew up with the stories of, you know, like Ira Hayes, and so I was kind of, I believed in the whole baloney that was given to us, and went to Vietnam expecting to hold up all those dominoes falling and the whole bit. And I thought, you know, because I didn't have a family that I knew of, and I wasn't married, and that if someone could die, I could. And I hadn't registered for the draft. I had run away and from boarding school. And so I figured, well, I could die. And when I went over there and until the first shot was fired over my head, did I realize I didn't want to die. I wanted to live.
You had an epiphany about living.
Yes. And so I really worked at coming back alive.
Good. So yeah, it's when you get right there, when you have hot lead coming your direction.
Yeah. Well, my first operation was Way City in Tet of 68. But like you said, I'm a poet, so I'd like to read a couple poems. This one is untitled. From my war, the combat time, soldiers' faces have faded. The names have been forgotten. But the death stays alive in me. The places are kind of unknown. The wounds are scars that heal fresh underneath my flesh. But I lived on for those who did not. And this one I call Agent White, Agent Orange, White, and Blue. Those are the names that they gave the pesticides that they sprayed. And I never knew what they were doing. They just come flying by and spray this stuff, like crop dusting. And we'd get full of it. You know, I remember wiping it off my face. But anyway, this is Agent Orange, White, and Blue. While the enemy was digging caves to hide underground from the chemical war of the United States to force out the guerrilla, the smart men of war forgot or intentionally allowed their own sons to stand naked above, breathing the agent brother's stench. I am now the son of dioxin, and you shall see me groping out of hidden underground caves looking for you, Uncle Sam.
Wow, nice. That's the first time I've heard that poem.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I heard all your poems.
Well, I wrote a lot. It's kind of, you know, I woke up in Vietnam. I was kind of badgered by welfare and being an orphan. And when I got over there and went through the Marine Corps stuff, it made me start thinking. And I realized that war was wrong and that what we were doing was wrong. And, you know, in fact, the nickname that the Marines gave me was Ho Chi. They called me Ho Chi, like Ho Chi Minh, you know. And, you know, I kind of, you know, the Vietnamese also treated me very well. I was surprised. I would be a point and come into a village and they would just surround me. And, you know, just like a rock star. I felt like a rock star walking into town, you know. And they'd be saying in Vietnamese, they'd say, well, we taught them, like, number one, you know. Number one was good, number 10 was bad. So they'd always be coming up to me and say, number one, you know. Samey, same, they'd say, you know. Samey, same eyes, samey, same hair. And I said, no. And then after a while, I started, oh, yeah, I think maybe we are, you know. And I started to realize that how wrong we were. My last assignment was defending a mobile gas refineries. There was two of them out in the bay. And Highway 1 that went to Vietnam was for transportation and Coca-Cola plant. And this was my assignment. I realized at the time this was economic and that it was totally wrong. And so I'm so surprised to find that here we are 50-some years after that, and it seems like that conflict that we was so far away is now here in the United States. The same ingredients are here. I mean, democracy falling down, the dominoes. We're worried about this goofy guy trying to be an authoritarian and ruining democracy and scaring us all and trying to build himself up. And we're living with all these lies. And I think it just makes me realize that the war that we fought then, it's the same. You walk outside the streets and, you know, there's murder and there's these deaths that are going on with drugs and all this homeless and all these problems that we should be devoting ourselves to instead of sitting around being threatened to lose our security in our old age or our health. And so it's the same war is existing as back then as now. And I think we need to really wake up and realize that we have to stand up now and be real more than ever. We have to be proud. I'm proud to be a liberal, progressive, you know, do-gooder or whatever they want to call me. Because I feel that people are the most important thing in the world, that life is sacred, that this earth is worthy of us to take care of, and that each other, we need to take care of each other. And that's what I feel that America was created for, that I used to wonder why everybody came to this land. And I said this at the Capitol the other day at a protest with, you know, thousands of people. I said, you know, this land is for all of us. It's a common destiny, not manifest destiny where Americans or Europeans have the right to interfere everywhere. It brought everybody here to learn how to live in a higher order. And I think that's what we're trying to learn. And I think people are trying to stop that now by creating fear because of money or whatever reasons they have. The main thing is we have to learn how to be a family here and put aside the differences of our skin color or our class or any kind of difference, put them away and end war. We have to start living in a new world that knows that talking is better than bombing. And the madness from the military needs to be stopped. I mean, it's just way out of line that they're cutting all this stuff for people and keeping the wars going on. It's just ridiculous, the genocide that's going on, ethnocide that's going on up in Ukraine and Gaza. So I think, you know, to me, what I was taught to be a American soldier really is helping me now. When I look around, as a point, I used to look for danger. And the danger is sitting in the White House. It's sitting inside your next door neighbor. It's sitting in the police force. It's sitting right there in front of us. But also your comrades are in next door and in the high places. So the polarization that's going on in the world today should make us really realize we have to grab hands and hold on to each other, those that think alike, that feel alike, because that's what's in this polarization. It's like a civil war that's going on internally. And so I'm glad to be on this show with you and Dave, because I think, you know, we have to wake up and face this stuff and start dealing with it.
Well, you know, Buffalo, you're a walking point for peace. You're the walking point for peace.
Oh, thank you.
You know, just so people know, a point person, like when you were with your Marine Corps squad or whatever, the point person goes out ahead by themselves just to see what's going on. It's actually a pretty dangerous position often, because you're there to draw fire, perhaps, and save everybody else. But you have these noble words now which go into it. But it's something that God instilled in you because of your being a point person there.
I think the reason I became point was we were in a major operation, and I saw the enemy, and I pointed him out way before everybody else did. And we'd go by the clock, and I pointed him out at about 8 o'clock, and then 9 o'clock, and then 10 o'clock. At about 11 o'clock, they finally stopped and went out to check what I was talking about, and we got caught in an ambush. So that night, the battalion commander said, who was that guy that was shouting, you know, they're over there? And so they brought me in, and he said, you're going to be my point after this. So me and this other Marine guy, who was another Indian, he was a Pima Indian from Arizona named Gage Blackwell, became scouts. And, you know, I did everything in my power not to run into an ambush again. And I never did get ambushed. And I never had to kill nobody. And I made a point of it. I was good at it because I could deal with this stuff. Some people had never slept in a outside their own home, had never gone hungry, had never been under distress or been bullied or anything. But I had gone through it all. And so when I went over to Vietnam, it was all easy. It was, I could see farther than other people. I could hear better than them. I could smell the enemy a mile away. And I tell everybody, hey, they're coming. They're over there. Let's go this way. And at first they used to say, oh, you're goofy, you know. But then they started to realize I wasn't goofy, that I knew what I was talking about.
Tom, whatever happened to your good friend, the other indigenous guy?
He got shot by a sniper, and then a head injury is a top priority. So we called in the helicopters, medevacs, but that sniper kept them going. As soon as they'd come near, he'd shoot and they'd fly off. And so we were going up and down this hill, this large hill, and we couldn't get him out of there. And it was like overnight. He was in the afternoon, he got shot. And overnight, we had to hold him, and he started regressing. And I remember at first he just said, well, now I'll really get to go home. Just normal, like we're talking now. And then he just started regressing because it was a head injury. He was hit in his head. And so he started talking like a little kid, you know. Oh, I want to go out. I want to see my mom. Where's my mom? Mm. My mom's mama, you know. And I was like, you know, going bananas, you know. And then finally there was a helicopter coming the next morning, and we saw it. We called out to it, and he said, we got a medevac. We need him to go back. And the pilot said, I can't. He said, I can't stop. He said, I'm on a mission. He said, you know, we were saying, what's the mission? You know, and more important than one of our guys that needs, you know, attention. He got hit in the head. He got shot in the head. And he said, I got to deliver the colonel's ice, his ice for his beer. And we just went, what? You know, what the hell? You know, and he said a few other words. And that pilot just went on. And Cage died there. And, you know, I have written a piece that I call Colonel's Ice about that. That the ice for his beer was more important than one of our people.
Wow. I'd like to hear that poem sometime. You haven't got it with you, do you?
I do, yeah.
Sure.
You could. All right. It's kind of more like a prose, but it's called The Colonel's Ice. I grew up being force-fed the John Wayne lies, that he shot and killed all the real Indians in the fantasy world of Hollywood. I wondered why the Indians always lost all the battles in those movies and books, not realizing who made those movies and books, what they were intended to do, exactly perpetuate that myth, that Indians were gone, that the white guys won it all. I also grew up watching Ira Hayes, the Pima Indian, put up the flag on Iwo Jima for the Marines who died drunk in a ditch. But I was also blessed to be exposed to the native world early in my childhood when my foster brother, older brother Brian, joined the USMC and visited our foster home. He was 6'7", Ojibwe from Cass Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. In his uniform, he showed us his eagle feather that he had been given in a ceremony. It would help him to return safe and unharmed. This made a huge impression upon me that years later I joined the Marines too. When I got to Vietnam in 1968, I met a Pima Indian from Arizona. Both of them ended up being used as points a lot of the time because war came easy to us. We became squad leaders and were used still as points. Our troops respected us both a lot. Once a very good sniper for the North Vietnamese Army shot a few points. Kenneth Blackwell, or Cage, that we called him, he took over point and got shot in the head. His unit went into shock. His first, he was just staggering around. His first lieutenant was staggering around just saying, KG got shot. He was so admired by his all he could have went home early. When our base was overrun by Viet Cong with satchel bombs, they would all get stoned and just have breech cloths and come in and blow up stuff with hand grenades and those satchels. They temporarily blinded Cage with a grenade, but he fought off two of them barehanded, and they retreated. His platoon asked him to stay, and he did. So when he got shot, it hit us all hard. I remember he was joking. He told me, now I can really go to home. A head injury is top priority, so he had requested a medevac copter to come in fast, but it received some fire from that sniper and took off. We went up the hill, same thing. It dragged on for a day. Cage began to regress, babble, and then cried like a baby. I remember being so upset, feeling so helpless, not being able to do anything for him. I saw a helicopter off in the horizon, and we called out. It was our battalion commander's helicopter. We asked him to take Cage. He replied to my disbelief, no, he couldn't stop. He had to get back to the rear before our colonel's ice melted for his beer. Cage did not make it. I cried as I heard him sing what sounded like a death chant or was his last breath. Everything from that day is cloudy and fuzzy in my mind. I remember that officer left soon after that, and we were all at the rear camp when he flew off. There's usually a gun salute, but we heard on our radios to stop shooting that rounds were hitting his helicopter. Cage got a Silver Star for his first attack. He was the bravest soldier I served with, and we got drunk in the rear area once and saluted everyone of our loved ones, our family, those we didn't even know. I only had foster family then. He sang some Pima songs, told me all about his reservation and people, and I will always honor him.
Wow.
Yes, you mentioned that you had grown up in a boarding school, which has been more and more coming to light of what a stain it is on the history of the United States and Canada, especially, too. And it was, of course, designed to, how did they say, beat the Indian out of you?
I didn't even know. They wouldn't even tell me what race I was. Some social worker had said that I was emotionally immature. Of course, I was a kid. And that I wasn't supposed to know. And they weren't going to tell me until I was 21 years old what nationality I was. So, I mean, every day in my childhood, I go crazy, you know, like, what the hell am I, you know? And I kept going, like, and I finally got to high school, and I asked my counselor, I was in Boystown, Nebraska, and I asked my counselor, I said, what am I? He said, I can't tell you, you know, and he had a big stack of papers on his desk. And finally, I'd go there before baseball, before basketball, before football. And every day I'd go there and I'd ask him. He had about seven kids, an Irish Catholic guy. And finally, I got to go to the bathroom. I'm going to be gone 5 minutes. If you look at these records, that's up to you. And he took off. So I looked in there and I saw my mom's name, you know, Jermaine LeBlanc. And the home was Veblen, South Dakota. Nationality, Sioux, Indian, and father unknown. I went, So I found out what I was, but that was about it. Took me a while to get to meet my real family.
Natives have probably the highest percentage of people go into the military.
Yeah.
And some people say, well, what the heck? They were treated so poorly. by manifest destiny, by settlers going out there and might makes right, and we are, you know, we, God guns, guts and guns.
But we're the sovereign. Indians are the sovereign of this land. Yeah. Sovereignty didn't come from king or queen of Spain or England or France. It come from the Indians. And we're still here. After all this genocide and extermination and all this treatment and all that stuff they did with border, we're still here.
Yeah.
I was 4 years old, and I had never stayed in a place more than 1 month. I was in, you know, like 105 different social placements. I was moved more than your trash. But, you know, I survived it. I found my people. I found my ways, and I realized this land is ours. It's a different way of looking at it. We don't look at it in ownership like we got the title in our pocket. Yeah. We have a relationship with it. This earth is our mother. And you treat your mother with love. And that's what we do. We might be the ones that are suffering from alcoholism and drug addiction and poverty and all this kind of stuff of being outsiders. But we're the real power here. If you look at any Indian today, the reason in their name is a solution. For Dakotas, you know, it means friendly people. The Ojibwe's, it means the original people. The Ho-Chunk, it's like people with a big voice. Every one of them says the people. Yeah. The United States of America does not say the United States of people. Because it isn't.
Yeah.
It's everybody ran away and was persecuted from someplace else and came here. And now they're trying to stop that. I mean, why? Because they're worried that that there's not going to be enough for everybody? This is such a myth. Everybody, there's enough here for us all.
Yeah.
We can keep on building houses. We can keep on creating phony money and all this kind of stuff and live. The main thing is the real things. Love and compassion and kindness and goodness. Those things are what's important. Not how big your stock returns are or your bank budget is or your fancy car or designer clothes. The main thing is how many friends do you got? How many people do you help? How many people are helping you? Because hard times are going to come to us all. And we're going to not have to worry about beating each other up, but sharing. Because it's going to take a little bit to learn how to give a little bit and not stuff yourself to the max.
Yeah, so true. You know, our friend Mitch Walkinelk, he was on stage with Larry Long, and Larry was going to sing Woody Guthrie's "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land, Our Land," right? And Mitch walked off the stage.
Uh-huh.
He said, "No, it's not." You know, I just think, and our good friend Chris Montanupo wrote a whole book about the settler colonizing and how the genocide of the Native people in this country was almost 97%. 97%, that's a conservative estimate of how many people were, how many indigenous people were killed.
But the fact is, today, everybody that's supposed to be liberal or progressive are the Indians. That's who they're after. That's what's happening. You're all, you know, I have a poem that I started writing, and I said, how does it feel now that the privilege is being erased from you? How does it feel now that you're not... You're being ignored.
Yeah.
How does it feel that you're being discriminated against? And people are beginning to start to realize what it feels like to be persecuted like that and treated like that. But we survive. We survive. We will survive all this stuff. We've survived over 35 presidents and terms of whatever they are, up and down, left and right, and good and bad, and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just because we've got a loudmouth in there. I'm the same age as that guy in there. And I realize, you know, what a fool. I mean, this is a fool. This is a clown. And he's sitting there representing. He's the commander in chief. That's a guy whose finger is sitting there with it. I don't trust him. I don't believe in what he's saying. And I know there's many people that believe that he's the great hope or whatever. But, I mean, when you start terminating stuff like color, just because for the sake of what, you know. I mean, white is a color, too, you know. And you start getting this inclusion and stuff, you know, trying to terminate those that need to be included because you don't think there's enough to include them. Well, what is going on?
Yeah.
So now, common sense has to take over.
Now, Tom, your group that you are part of is Oyate Houghton, and basically what you're doing, Oyate Houghton, is you do the Buffalo Show, and but you do more than that.
Hmm.
You want to talk a little bit more about your work?
Yeah, well, we're kind of like a native-led arts group, and we put on different kinds of forums for to help the minds of people. You know, we say for the next 500 years, because we want people to realize that it's going to take beyond our generation. We have to lay the seeds now that will, you know, bear fruit maybe, you know, because I was taught, my understanding of seven generations is that it's three generations back. That's my great-grandparents. They were in Fort Snelling. There was 10 of my family in Fort Snelling and more down in Mankato. And three generations ahead, your great-grandchildren, I have like 10 of them. And then you, in your present generation, you are the middle. And so it's like you can see this. You could talk with them. You could actually be alive with the seven generations from the past and the present. And that's what we have to start to begin to realize, that we're not just selfish, solo, temporary, kind of solitary figures, that we're a lot more. And so it's this kind of thinking that needs to be brought back. And those that are standing for good and compassion, I think, have to stand together, because we got to make ourselves get beyond war. We don't need war. It's just a big business, and they're just making a lot of waste. So we need to stop that and spend it for something better.
Yes, that is our only hope.
Yeah.
Because instead of just always thinking about how can I make a buck off this something or other that you find here or there, I mean, something as basic, Winona LaDuke said, you got to love water, not oil.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I got another poem. Can I read it?
Yeah,
why did you do
this?
How about the walking on Franklin Avenue?
That's what I'm talking about.
You've read my mind.
Okay, well, you read my mind.
Easy read.
I'm the poet.
It's like a comic book.
Walking down Franklin Avenue straight out of Vietnam, I saw the Minneapolis police throwing native people into paddy wagons like sacks of drunk potatoes. That image, it's still so clear in my mind. All those bodies laid out on top of each other. This aimless walker questioned, pointed out that they were human beings. I was told to mind my own business, that they were the law. And then the anger blew up within me. And AIM was born there on Franklin Avenue too. We all began to stand up, speak out about that brutality and all the centuries of injustice so big that it can never be undone. We followed our hearts and not our rational minds down that street, over the roads, through all of Indian country, we walked into historic change. We, the AIM, still evolving, are still revolving. We had to survive all that hate. We patrolled the streets with our noble native blood. We picked ourselves up, some sober and some not. We revived our dormant culture. We began to piece together our fragmented circle. If we heard of someone hurt, we reacted. We responded. We worked. We cared. We recreated the rebirth of the indigenous soul, the native pride of the original ways, following the natural laws, walking down Franklin Avenue, past police, City Hall, and all that hate to aim for freedom. We chase the dream down of our before. We are AIM, the American Indian Movement, forever walking down Franklin Avenue.
Well, you know, it was so inspiring during the 60s when AIM was happening and things were happening on Franklin Avenue, because it was so exciting that throughout much of society, we were all starting to wake up. I mean, like the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's not right what's going on down south, and we found out up north, too. And then the women's movement. Oh, they're not, you don't call them girls. Yeah. You think differently about it. That was a gay liberation movement. American Indian Movement here. It was so exciting that all these people were saying, here's my reality. Here's how we add to this world. And we've had to learn more about how it all fits together. I mean, I found out a heck of a lot more about the history of the U.S. I mean, I'd studied it. I also always felt bad for how some of the groups, Indian groups, were hounded. But I didn't know how to put it together with everything else, that it was part of this making of a national empire.
Mm.
And that,
In like 1924, it's both when Indians got the right to vote and women got the right to vote.
That same year.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it coincides. You know, it's like the founding fathers, the white guys that founded this country, went and studied the Iroquois Confederacy.
Yes.
To find out how democracy and all that worked. And they plagiarized it. But they forgot, I think, an important ingredient, which was clan mothers, the grandmas. The women had the real power. They could take out any war chief, peace chief, any leader. They could make the policy and make the direction. United States needs clan mothers back. They need to reinstitute this to where there's some grandmothers that are sitting in there that nurtured and fostered all these children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren to realize that we need life. We don't need death and consumption and confusion. We need understanding and caring that takes a hug and a kiss and a smile is much better than a shout and a pounding, which is what is happening to us all now. We're all running scared.
Well, and on May 13th at the Bryant Lake Bowl, you can see Tom and the Buffalo Weavers and a whole bunch of other folks are going to be on the bill for that show.
Yeah, it should be a good show.
Can't wait.
So if you can.
So that was May 13th.
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday.
At 7 p.m.
7 p.m. at the Bryant Lake Bowl over on Lake Street. And
yeah, it's Bryant and Lake Street, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, well, and I know you've been doing that for
since
a while.
2016, I think.
Is that long?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting performance space there. It's very good and all that. It's it's interesting how what's going on now, where we're they're really, really trying hard. People who think that they're in charge of everything and everything, that they're trying to declare an emergency. Yeah. And you got to hate these people over here because they don't have the right documents. And even though they've been 10 years here, making fine, upstanding families, working, got to pick them up by the ears and toss them into the refuse pile. You do start to see some people are starting in some of the letters to the editor and sometimes on some of the...
I do remember a story about anti-immigrant people that were someplace in Arizona, and this native guy came started yelling at him and said, you're the immigrants. Go back to where you came from.
Yeah, I bet that caused him to, what the heck are you talking about?
Yeah, where do you deport the native people?
I don't know. We're home, you know. That's...
And natives had developed a long-term strategy for living.
Yeah.
How to live in harmony.
Keep your mother alive.
It's always a good plan.
And learn how to get along. The children just don't know how to get along. And I think it's going to take some strong people and people with courage to stand up and be good. Because that's what we need now. We need good, kind, compassionate, reasonable people that being real. Because these unreal people are going nuts. And, you know, I don't sit there and take it lightly. I think we have to really reinforce ourselves stronger than ever. I'd say be a little bit gooder each day. If you just have one little good thought that you can have that you didn't have yesterday, the world's off a little bit better. Because there's some nut that's got 35 bad ones, you know, more than he had the day before. So I think we need... just to reinforce each other and say, hey, all you good people, let's join together and take back this world because it belongs to us all.
We all have to be people who, as you say, support Mother Earth. And you think seven generations, three back, you said, three forward. Sometimes it's seven forward, but it's... you want to make it so that the world can continue, because right now it's getting hotter and hotter, and the water is getting whatever, the oceans are too hot. So, but it takes people to not hang back, thinking, well, maybe Washington will, they'll do a little buh, 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 and then it'll be okay again. Yeah. But that's not how... a civic democracy where we all participate and we all make it, we all got to go work together and go into that. And it's that's something we should carry in from what was learned.
Yeah, it's it seems like the modern American thinking right now is more like 7 weeks rather than seven generations. It's like people are looking at their cell phones and they're not worried. I was saying that the national bird should change from the eagle to the ostrich, because that is one of the biggest problems. Although I'll have to say this about the current resident of the White House, is that he's gotten people's attention. The last couple of things over at the Capitol, it's like 35,000 people.
Yes.
Immigrant rights.
Yes. I think it's called A Day Without Immigrants. Hmm. Strong Buffalo, why don't you talk about... You're talking to that large group at the state capitol when you were asked to be part of that, how you went about thinking about it and going into it and what you did.
Well, I just told them that You know, for over 500 years, this has been the land and the refuge for the world's refugee. Why let hate stop that now? So it's the reason that everyone has come here is to learn how to live together in a higher order. And we're a long ways away from that. But that's what we need to do. We need to realize that this is the new world that we need to make a family, and that we're all relatives. Mataqui Oyase has been interpreted as all my relations, but it really means I am one who's trying to be a good relative in a world of unknown. And that's what we all are, trying to be good in this world that's full of so much strange stuff.
That's why it was so confounding during the last presidential election when you had, when Biden was still president, you had every day all these bombs exploding in Gaza. And it couldn't be an issue. The candidate, the Democratic candidate and the Republican candidate, all they do is, they can't see that if people don't, you know, complain about genocide, what are we here for? And the psychological impact, well, in fact, I've been alerted that in June, there's going to be a psychologist coming here who coming from the occupied West Bank in the Palestinians, the having to do with the trauma that it sets off, because it is, when you're living under it all the time, there's no nothing which is different. The guy, the Palestinian guy who was a leader in some of the stuff in Colombia, he lives in Vermont. He says he had to come here to know how it felt to be freedom of movement, freedom, try to be freedom of speech. But now, both sides, there's hardly anybody in the official world that can say, open your eyes, look what's going on every day. Don't keep sending huge amount of munitions there.
Well, you know, and I think oftentimes that people are, they just want to say, Republicans. But you know, when Biden was in there, and they said, well, Biden, he got Leonard Peltier out of the prison. Well, he did it like 2 seconds before he was walking out the door. He could have done this 4 years ago, but he didn't. He waited, let him wait 4 more years.
But, I mean, if you look at war and what's going on in Ukraine and Gaza, who's making those bombs? Who's the ones that's profiting from that war? It's us. And we're responsible. They're making war in our name. They're killing people by the thousands in our name, destroying these countries in our name. And we have to stop them. I don't want war anymore. I don't want anybody to be killed in anywhere in our name. So stop it.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
The Minnesota Twins have had their fair share of baseball legends, but one name stands out, Kirby Puckett. Born in Chicago, but adopted by Minnesota as one of our own, Puckett became the heart and soul of the Twins during the 80s and 90s. But he wasn't just a player, he was a spark plug. He led the Twins to their first World Series win in 1987, and then again in 1991, with moments etched in Minnesota history.
Puckett swings and hits a blast!
In Game 6 of the 91 World Series, Puckett stunned with a walk-off homer in the 11th inning and forced a Game 7. But perhaps most famously, Kirby performed a gravity-defying leap at the Metrodome wall to rob a home run. And that's the kind of magic Kirby Puckett brought to the team. His career ended when he woke up at 35 years old with no vision in his right eye as a result of glaucoma, ending Kirby Puckett's career overnight as an all-star baseball player.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's 1 o'clock, just right on the nuts, right at the top. You're listening to Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM, KFAI Minneapolis, St. Paul, and all around the world.